Hello, and welcome to Polylog, a weekly dialogue on the substance and style of the Sunday morning political shows, where we take a critical look at the policymaker, the politician, and the journalist, because each is critical and each demands criticism. I'm Naomi Soto Steitel, your co-host and health policy professional based in California.
And I'm Brendan Steitel Soto, your other co-host and communication specialist in government, technology, and healthcare. Our goal for Polylog is to look at all sides of the Sunday morning political talk shows.
We discuss guest performances, the style and quality of questions by the host, and the overall usefulness of roundtable discussions.
Polylog is our attempt to find, praise, and demand constructive political dialogue. But today, we have a very special episode for you. We thought, with all of the talk about the 2020 Democratic candidates, things really heating up, it would be cool to have a series of episodes every so often in your podcast feed where we take a closer look at Democratic candidates and their stump speeches. These are the speeches that they're taking around the country. They're their kind of well-worn phrases that they're building up their case to be president from state to state to state to state. And these things find their way into their interview answers. They're going to find their way into the debate stages. They're going to find their way into candidate forums. I mean, you're going to find these same messages and these explications of their platform all over the place. So we thought, let's go straight to the horse's mouth, or the donkey's mouth in this instance, and analyze them one by one, starting at the top and then moving our way down the list as we're able to.
And top being the top of the polls, not the
exactly.
Top of the candidates.
Absolutely.
Because we would not say this is the top candidate so far, but former Vice President Joe Biden is kind of top of the polls. And he has been out campaigning the last few weeks, finally, officially, after kind of an unofficial start to a campaign for what felt like a year.
And
maybe like 3 months, but it felt like a long time.
And Joe Biden will be a new voice to listeners of Polylog because he has not appeared on any of the Sunday morning political shows at all over the course of our coverage. And we'll see when he actually ultimately does. But that doesn't mean that he hasn't been talked about a ton on the Sunday shows. And we think it's very valuable. We're actually out of state this week at a wedding in Chicago today, as you're listening to this. Or no, actually, we just got back.
What is time?
Yeah, exactly. But we thought we want to put something valuable in your feed, and hopefully you'll find this as valuable as we did. And of course, next week, we will be back with a regular episode covering our 4 Sunday morning political shows.
So we're going to be looking at one of the early speeches of Joe Biden. This was done on May 18th in Philadelphia. And even though he has been representing the state of Delaware for decades, he loves to claim that he's a Pennsylvania boy at heart. And so it was kind of like a coming home of sorts.
And this campaign is just getting started. And I promise you this, no one's going to work longer. No one's going to campaign harder to win your hearts, your trust, and your support than the son of Captain Eugene Finney from Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Joseph R. Biden Jr. from Delaware.
Yeah, he was raised in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and this was what he called his kickoff event. It followed 2 weeks of other events that began with another sort of campaign launch. So it was a very long rollout. But since then, we were like, okay, let's pull up one of his later stump speeches. We couldn't find it anywhere on YouTube, on C-SPAN, nowhere. This is the latest thing that he has said that is available out there. But it's a good one because although it's a very written speech, you know, a lot of these stump speeches, they kind of the candidates will memorize and talk about in people's living rooms. This is a really great start and serves as a really good founding document for his campaign.
In 1776, the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident. These words are the basis for the American creed: equality, equity, fairness, decency. America didn't live up to that promise for most of the people at the time, the people of color, for women, but we were born of an idea that every single solitary person, given half a chance, no matter where they're from, given half a chance, there's not a single thing they cannot do if they work at it. Nothing's beyond their capacity. That's who we are.
Okay, so in terms of the structure for today's show, we're going to be looking at, one, our general impressions, what kind of stood out to us. Two, we're going to look at the goals of Biden's speech. Three, we're going to look at kind of the feelings or the images that Biden was trying to invoke throughout his speech. And then four, just kind of the general policies that Biden talked about or really didn't talk about.
And then, of course, we'll wrap it up with kind of final thoughts.
100%. So starting off, general impressions, Brendan, what's your general sense of it?
My general sense is, and it might be the same sense as some of our listeners here on Polylog who've been paying attention to the 2020 race, is that this speech, and you'll hear from the many clips we're going to play for you, this speech was so different from what I've heard from all the other presidential candidates. Now, you can decide whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is very, very different. The other candidates focus on specific policies. They focus on largely kind of introducing themselves and who they are to the American people, which is kind of new. And so they do this in different ways. The other candidates, they tell personal stories and anecdotes and explicate their resumes. That's not what we heard here much at all. This was very much I'm going to reach back to what I think is the core of, you know, Americana. I'm going to evoke that, and I'm going to say, this is how I'm going to distinguish myself from everyone else in the race, and that one word is unity. That's what he's trying to get to. So it was just, it was so, so different, and it kind of felt like a campaign speech of yore, and not a bad one, certainly not a bad one. It was well written, but definitely not what we're used to seeing in today's more modern political field. Naomi, what were your kind of first takeaways?
In general, I felt like my eyes glazed over the bulk of it. It didn't really resonate with me. And I think part of that was it truly felt like, you're saying, a speech of yore. Like, it felt like a speech from 2007, 2010. Like, if this was 2010, I'd be like, wow, this is so fresh. But it's 2019 and it did not feel embedded in the times that we're in, even though it was definitely centered around President Trump and kind of the division. And, you know, we'll talk about unity in a second. But I don't know, I didn't feel rooted in the reality of how Americans and how Democrats feel today. It felt like a longing for something we've had before, as opposed to a looking ahead.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And then the final thing I'll say before we launch into here and kind of talk about the content is this speech taught me a lot about Joe Biden and how he's positioning himself in this Democratic race, so much more than I have learned from reading countless news articles about Joe Biden's candidacy. So I was really interested and happy to find here kind of how he thinks he's going to distinguish himself from the Democratic field, how he's going to frame himself differently from Donald Trump, what are the topics he's going to move forwards with. Like, there's a lot here. And even though Joe Biden hasn't really been out there that much, he's more been talked about than is talking, there's a lot of answers right here in this speech. And so I was really happy to walk away with that.
So that takes us to the goals of this speech. What do you think Biden was trying to accomplish here?
I think number one was he's trying to say, this is why I'm running. And he answered that question directly. Let's take a listen.
Folks, we started this campaign when we did. I said I was running for three reasons. The first is to restore the soul of the nation, the essence of who we are. Yeah. I mean it. And the second is to rebuild the backbone of this nation. And the third, to unite this nation.
Okay, so these are kind of big objectives for sure. And I'm trying to kind of pinpoint or vocalize somehow why I kind of don't believe it. And I'm not sure if I have an answer, but for me, it just felt like big words that don't mean a lot. How about you, Brendan? Am I being too harsh?
Well, they're very, very big thematic aims, as you mentioned there. I mean, I almost imagine, like, can you imagine in a job interview where someone says, well, you know, how are you going to be in this job? And you say, I'm running to unite the nation to be one America. Okay, what does that mean exactly? How are you going to do that? He doesn't go into really deep specifics in the speech, but I don't know. I think what bothers me is that there's three of them and there really should just be two of them. three of these goals: restore the soul of America, rebuild the backbone of a nation, unite the nation to be one America. I think really the unite and restore are very similar in his minds. And it's hard in the speech to determine, like, when is he talking about restoring the soul of America and when is he talking about uniting the nation? But overall, I would say, just doing my best guess, his restore the soul of America is Donald Trump is an aberration, right? He does not stand for what America stands for. And we hear from Joe Biden what America stands for, and he reads it to us. He quotes the speech on the poem on the Statue of Liberty. He quotes the U.S. Constitution to us. He quotes the Gettysburg Address to us, and we'll play some of that here. But basically he's saying, Donald Trump, he's not about the same things as these things are about. It's almost like that test, the part of the SAT test where it's like, which one of these does not belong? You know, it's like, oh, the words on the Statue of Liberty, the U.S. Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, and Donald Trump's tweets. Which one does not belong? Right? Okay, you tell me, listener, which one doesn't belong?
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
It is for us to be dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that a government of, by, and for the people shall not perish from the earth. It offers hope to the tired, the poor, your huddled masses to breathe free.
And here's the third clip here. Here's Donald Trump. Sadiq Khan, who by all accounts has done a terrible job as mayor of London, has been foolishly nasty to the visiting president of the United States, by far the most important ally of the United Kingdom. He is a stone-cold loser who should focus on crime in London, not me. Khan reminds me very much of our very dumb and incompetent mayor of New York City, de Blasio, who has also done a terrible job, only half his height. In any event, I look forward to being a great friend to the United Kingdom, and I'm looking very much forward to my visit. Landing now! From the desk of the President of the United States.
I'm gonna take a wild guess and, you know, purely conjecture that the last one does not belong.
That does not belong. So I think that's what Joe Biden's first plank is. Restore the soul of America, i.e. Etch-a-Sketch, shake away Donald Trump from American history. So that's the restore the soul of America, number one of Biden's three parts. Number two, rebuild the backbone of America. I think that's where Biden's talking about his policies, education, healthcare, climate change. That's where those fit in. And then the unite the nation to be one America, number three, Biden's third plank. I think that is, I can work with the Republicans to get things done. We can compromise, and I have a proven track record there, and we don't have to be as contentious as Trump is. What do you think, Naomi?
The contrast here is definitely President Trump. I mean, he's kind of narrowed the field. He's like skipped the primary practically, according to his objectives, where he's not even trying to compete against the other Democratic candidates. He's just already pinning himself against President Trump. But I think what also stands out to me is kind of the restore the soul of America and unite the nation. You know, it's optimistic, but it gives me like a weird heebie-jeebie vibes of I'm the only one who can bring us back together, which is very reminiscent to Trump's I alone can fix it.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
So, I mean, not my favorite vibe here. Not at all.
Yeah, there's something a little too grandiose in it. And I think that grandiosity is what I talked about in the beginning, where it feels very different from other Democratic candidates who approach it, the office and the task of running for president, a little more humbly and try to be a little more relatable to people. He's not trying to be relatable. He's trying to be, you know, he invokes the folksiness. He says folks, folks, folks all the time. But he's not saying I'm a regular Joe, even though he is a Joe. He is Joe. I do disagree with you a little bit, Naomi.
Lame.
On the he's not, you know, he's kind of skipped the primary. What I see here is, I mean, maybe he's trying to skip the primary. Certainly he would love to skip the primary. But I was surprised to see him contrast himself with other Democrats in the race and with what the political pundits are saying. so directly. Let's take a listen to that.
Now, some of these same people are saying, you know, Biden just doesn't get it. You can't work with Republicans anymore. That's not the way it works anymore.
You got it.
Well, folks, I'm going to say something outrageous. I know how to make government work.
Yeah.
Not because I've talked or tweeted about it, but because I've done it.
Yeah.
I've worked across the aisle to reach consensus, to help make government work in the past. I can do that again with your help.
Yeah.
For me, our principles must never be compromised, but compromise itself is not a dirty word. Consensus is not a weakness. It's the only way our founders down the road there thought it was the only way we could govern. It was necessary. It was designed the way the Constitution sits. It requires consensus.
So I was really excited to hear this because I think it's something we might hear in a question by Chuck Todd or Chris Wallace, actually reading back to them something somebody wrote. You know, some say Biden doesn't get it and can't work, you know, that we can't work together. How do you prove to people that you get it? And here he is answering that question.
I mean, yes, this section is about trying to be the more optimistic Democratic candidate. I just felt like this was such a small piece of his speech where everything else seems so singularly focused on President Trump. Like, this little piece does exist, but I just don't think it outweighs all the other anti-Trump sentiment in the speech.
But I do think that in this section, it's not just what we played here. There's the part where he goes into talking about how bipartisanship can work. And I think he knows that he's gotten a lot of pushback from Democrats and other political commentators who say that his rosy view that Trump truly is an aberration, that Republicans will come back to their senses after Trump is out of office and want to work together again and compromise. I think there's been a lot of pushback on that, and he's trying to reassert himself and say, no, my basic argument for unity is still sound. And when he makes that argument, he uses, I mean, not really the best example. He kind of immediately pivots to talking about the Affordable Care Act and accidentally notes one important fact about that. Let's take a listen.
In the day we passed health care. Yeah, health care. A lot of presidents before have tried it. Other administrations have not been able to do it. But it was done by Barack Obama without a single Republican vote. So I know how to get things done helping. I know how to go toe-to-toe with the GOP, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, this just seems completely contradictory to, I mean, okay, there's a few things. One, of course, like millions of people can now have health insurance without being kicked off for pre-existing conditions. You know, Medicaid was expanded in a lot of places in the U.S. Like, there's all these things that are, you know, of course, worth bragging about if you were in the Obama administration. So that part doesn't surprise me. I think what was astounding is that Biden notes, like, singularly, like, highlights that they were able to pass it without a single Republican vote. Yet his whole thing was that we should be able to find compromise with the Republicans and, you know, we need to reach consensus, which is completely not what was done with the Affordable Care Act. So it just seemed like they wanted to kind of use this shiny object, but not realizing how distracting it was from everything else they said.
Yeah, it's literally like that legal objection, facts not in evidence. Yeah, and I do want to say that Vice President Biden does provide at least one, and I only counted one example of successful bipartisanship. It was from 2009, where he helped find and persuade Republicans to vote for legislation that would help reduce the impact of the financial crisis.
Look at the Recovery Act. The Recovery Act, the cornerstone of the nation's economic recovery from the depths of the greatest financial crisis short of a depression that we ever faced in our history.
Yes.
And that's a big reason. Big reason we now have had 10 years of uninterrupted economic growth. But we need it. We needed to find three Republicans in the United States Senate to get it passed. It was my job to find them, persuade them. I did, they did, and the country did better than it has before. Look, the Recovery Act helped save this nation from economic ruin.
Yes, it did.
To get down to it, we had to get the work done. We had to bring a few Republicans along. And if we hadn't done it, we could have had another Great Depression or economic ruin.
That's right.
So, folks, working together matters. It matters. The American people want their government to work. And I don't think that's too much for them to ask.
So that kind of summarizes the goals of Biden's speech. Were there any kind of strong images or memories or kind of anything that was, you feel like they were trying to invoke in you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was just... It was like our American history book in high school, you know, the thick textbook. What was the name of that? It was like American Journey or something like that. And it had a picture. I think it had that famous painting of all the flags. I think it was all the flags. Either all the flags in New York or they were like a bunch of American flags flying in Paris. It's kind of this impressionist painting of American flags in a cityscape. I feel like that's what he was trying to evoke. And he did that, as we mentioned earlier, by harking back to and reading to us directly the U.S. Constitution, the Gettysburg Address, the poem on the Statue of Liberty. But I want to pause here on what he said about the Constitution, because he's not just evoking 1776, or in that case, 1787, when it was written. He's evoking something we might remember from recent modern political history. Take a listen.
We the people, both, and we got to remember this, both were statements of a common purpose of one people, one nation. Our Constitution doesn't begin with the phrase, we the Democrats or we the Republicans. And it certainly doesn't begin with the phrase, we the donors. Look, it began with the phrase that stands for, we're all in this together.
That's right.
So that phrase, our Constitution doesn't begin with we the Democrats, we the Republicans, it's so similar to what basically launched Obama's career into national politics. The speech that he gave at the 2004 Democratic Convention, where ultimately John Kerry was nominated.
E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq, and there are patriots who supported the war in Iraq. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America.
So what do you think of that, Naomi? Kind of harking back and echoing Barack Obama pretty directly there.
I mean, not surprising at all. I mean, he's trying to anchor or tie himself to the memories and the feelings that people have from President Obama. I think it's different hearing it from a white man, I think. Like, it's interesting to think about the limits of language when they're repeated by someone else, just kind of as an exercise, because there's just certain things that you can't repeat from someone else and have them invoke the same feeling. And I think they can be similar, or it's possible to kind of still be inspiring, but it's not going to be that same level of a young black senator at the DNC convention, you know, reminding us that we're all part of the same country. Like, it just doesn't invoke the same feeling.
Oh my gosh. Like, what you said there absolutely gave me a flashback to this scene in The Lost World, Jurassic Park, the movie, where...
Oh, my God.
Listen.
How are you bringing Jurassic Park into this?
I am. Listen.
Jesus Christ.
So in that movie, everyone remembers in the first Jurassic Park, there's this...
Oh, my gosh, Reddit.
There's this guy with his white beard, and he's got this vision. John Hammond has this vision for dinosaurs in this whole park, and it's very inspiring and exciting, and then it all goes to hell, right? Well, in the second movie, John Hammond's, I guess, nephew, I think it's his nephew, has taken over the company, is trying to exploit it. Things don't go very well on the ground. They're walking through the jungle. He's walking, Ian Malcolm is walking through the jungle, played by Jeff Goldblum, walking through the jungle, talking to this nephew who's trying to evoke that same visionary stance, and it's just not working.
Say, I haven't had a chance to wish you luck on your new business venture. You're off to a promising start.
My team is intact, Doctor. I'm sorry for the loss of your man. You know, it's very easy to criticize someone who generates an idea, someone who assumes all the risks, someone who puts everything on the
table. You try to sound like Hammond, it just comes off like a hustle. I mean, it's not your fault. They say talent skips a generation. So, hey, I'm sure your kids are going to be sharp as tacks.
This is new levels of bringing in Jurassic Park into our everyday life, Brendan.
It's so relevant to our modern American politics.
Oh,
a lot of people don't think about it, but they don't realize that's an important...
It is not possible for me to roll my eyes any further.
Taking dinosaurs off this island is the worst idea in the long, sad history of bad ideas, and I'm going to be there when you learn that.
Our Constitution doesn't begin with the phrase, we the Democrats or we the Republicans.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
But if you didn't kind of connect that to Barack Obama's speech, because, you know, it's very thematically similar, but it doesn't mention Barack Obama explicitly, well, no worries. Just a few minutes later, Joe Biden not only, as we were saying, evokes Barack Obama, but kind of conjures him as if he's a legend of the old times.
I think we should step back and say something we don't often say enough as a party or as a nation.
What's that?
Barack Obama was an extraordinary man.
Yeah!
Extraordinary person.
We will not see his like again. I mean, doesn't it? It sounds like Barack Obama is dead. Barack Obama was an extraordinary president. He was this and he was that. And it's like, he's still alive, you know. We know him. He still is. He's not was.
Yeah, Obama's very much alive. He was at the game 2 of the NBA Finals in Toronto this weekend, wearing a very suave leather black jacket. I mean, he's... He's very much still here with us.
He's also quite a bit younger than Joe Biden himself. But, you know, of course, it does Joe Biden very well to say things like Barack and my administration and when Barack and me did this.
It's very convenient.
Yeah. As pundits are fond of reminding people, Barack Obama is the most popular figure in the Democratic Party. The final thing that is important to note here, it's not just about looking to the past, whether it's the far past or it's the past of Barack Obama. It's also talking about American exceptionalism. And I mean, I don't know that I've heard a more chest-pounding statement of American exceptionalism.
Nothing makes me gag more than chest-pounding, but that's fine.
But I haven't heard this kind of American exceptionalism from any of the other Democratic candidates this year.
Our workers are 3 times as productive as workers in Asia. That's a fact. Number one, we have the biggest economy in the world. We have the strongest military in the history of the world. We have the most innovative entrepreneurs. We're virtually energy independent. We have more great research universities in this city, this state, this country than all the world combined. That's a fact. No other nation can match us if we step up. We lead by the power of our example, not by the example of our power.
I think I'd probably push back on any language on American exceptionalism. I'm just thinking like all the parts that are effed up by America that are so easy to like leave off of this list. Like, for instance, the gun violence in this country,
which is exceptional.
Which it's true.
In a terrible way.
Yeah. Or even the state of infant and maternal mortality rates for Black women in this country, looking at how much we spend on healthcare and how poor our outcomes are.
But that's not inspiring in a speech.
I know, but those are exceptional garbage accomplishments of this country. And it's just, I don't know. What I'm saying is any language of American exceptionalism, I tend to resist intensely. And so I don't know if it's a question of I don't buy it here versus I don't buy it anywhere. I think it's probably the latter. But I just, it's all just too easy to only look at the good stuff that America does.
Okay, but I mean, he does confront a lot of, you know, a number of issues in this speech, often pointing the finger at Donald Trump as the root of many of them. But I do think there's a place in a political speech and a place for a president to try to rally the troops, get people excited, you know, like you would in a business, to try to get people inspired by who they are and not make them feel bad about their country, like encourage them to feel like they can do something positively.
Yeah, I guess
make a positive impact.
I guess that's fair. It's just all of it all at once. I alone can fix this. I'm going to unite the country. America's the best. Like all of it all in the same like 12 minutes or however long this speech is like too much for me. Like I can handle like one, maybe two of those things in a combination. I can handle all of them.
I think what Joe Biden is doing here is he's trying to make a play for, he's trying to say that you don't have to be a right-wing nationalist to be a patriotic American who's proud of their country. I think that's what he's trying to regain and show. And I think he's also trying to throw out the arguments that many on the right made about Barack Obama, that he was like going on this apology tour, apologizing for America, and all of that. I think he's trying to firmly say, we should be proud, and I'm going to make you feel proud to be an American because we have a lot to be proud of. We have things to fix, but a lot to be proud of. That's an interesting, explicit, very explicit message that we heard here that I haven't seen as specifically laid out by any of the other candidates. Okay, Naomi, let's take a look at policies. You know, there's been a lot of history. Where's the policy in this speech?
Yeah, so Vice President Biden went through kind of a litany of various issues that are important to him. Some of the ones that he included in his speech are education. He thinks we should have free community college. He did not say anything about four universities, public or private, only community colleges. I think he also mentioned a little bit about kind of workforce development and vocational training as well, if I remember correctly. Some of the other issues include not Medicare for all, but more like a public option he thought was a better step forward. And then he also mentioned quite a bit around climate change and kind of regulations and things like that and how we have to kind of protect the air for the future. So of all these issues, did any of these kind of resonate with you or did you find one more effective than another, Brendan?
No. I felt like they were pretty kind of like weak tea, if you could call it that. And it started, the first time he mentioned policy was the perfect example of that. Take a listen to this.
If I'm elected your president, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make progress on the matters that matter most.
I mean, I know he's talking about what he's going to do, but it's very hand-wavy. I'm going to do, you know, whatever it takes to make progress on, you know, whatever matters, you know. And it's like, no, you have to be specific. You have to care. You have to put a plan forwards or have a vision that's inspiring and exciting and that can get us, I don't know, that can get Americans excited about the world that you're going to build. And there wasn't a lot of visioning here, right? I felt like that was kind of lacking. Even as he went over some of these proposals, which, you know, he talked about a Medicare buy-in option. That could be pretty big for people and make a big impact on people. But he just kind of explained it in a sentence or two and then moved on.
Folks, we all know the Affordable Care Act was a historic achievement. 20 million Americans got coverage. Over 100 million people with pre-existing conditions can no longer be denied coverage.
Great.
That's amazing. It restored dignity for the parents who couldn't afford to take care of their children, health care. And now we need to go to the next step. We shouldn't start over, and we surely shouldn't tear it down.
Yes.
To me, giving every American, the right to choose a public option like Medicare is the best way to get everybody covered, if they choose.
And even as he introduced education, which his wife is a lifelong educator, and actually quoted his wife, he did not provide, I don't know, much to get excited about in that area.
Folks, we have to get focused on the future. It's the only way we're going to invest in an educational system our people need to succeed in the 21st century. Jill always says, she's a community college professor, she always says, any country that out-educates us will out-compete us. That's just a natural fact. And folks, that success will come when we generate free community colleges, invest in job training and apprenticeships, continuing education, allowing people to fill jobs in the future, a stronger commitment to pre-K, and so much more.
It's not only about like where his policies stand on the spectrum of policies proposed by other Democratic candidates, it's where he puts them in this speech. They're not his main point.
It's just in real contrast to what we've seen from the other candidates with that really thrive in the specificity of their plans and being proud of. I'm thinking like Cory Booker's 14-point plan on gun violence. Elizabeth Warren has a plan on student debt. Like, there's all these various issues that they're just like, I'm going to think about this fully and have, you know, lots of options and really try to address this issue. And what Biden is doing instead is kind of wanting you to believe in his, I don't know, vigor to accomplish something, but not feel like, it doesn't feel like you can hold on to it in the same way.
Yeah, exactly. And missing from this were a whole slew of important policy issues that have been at the top of the list for Democrats. And so he didn't talk about the Supreme Court. He didn't talk about the middle class very much. He didn't talk about income inequality. He didn't talk about student debt. There was very little about the economy at all beyond what he and Barack Obama did in the financial crisis. He didn't talk about free trade or NAFTA or renegotiating trade deals. He didn't talk about Trump's tariffs. He didn't talk about foreign policy or LGBTQ rights, trans issues. He didn't talk about money in politics or campaign finance or about the Electoral College. There was nothing about the opioid crisis or guns. Like, it wasn't there. It's really surprising, like, how little this had to do with policy. And then the fact that any policy was included at all really shows us what he thinks is most important. And that's education, healthcare, climate change. But why do you think he did that, Naomi? Why do you think there wasn't a lot of policy here?
I think that's just not his it's not his primary focus. His primary focus is to get people to feel like they have an option if you are a moderate in any form and you're not supportive of the president, but you kind of, you know, does it mean you're kind of full of intense Democratic kind of energy or kind of the quote unquote far left, or it's not even that far left, but the left side of the Democratic Party? I mean, I think Biden is trying to give people an option, but it's not based off of what he wants to do. It's what he can accomplish.
Yeah, in fact, he's very explicit about it. And this is a quote we're going to play for you here that was quoted a lot after this speech.
Folks, we need a president who's willing to lead, who will insist on dramatic change for the sake of our children. Folks, let me tell you something. The single most important thing we have to accomplish to get this done, the single most important thing we have to accomplish is defeat Donald Trump.
I think this clip here is his way of saying policies aren't as important as having somebody like me who knows how to get things done and will be a champion for what you believe in, but can beat Trump.
And before we get onto kind of the closing segment of this episode, I just kind of wanted to kind of quickly go back to the issues and topics that he doesn't talk about. It's a much longer list than what he actually did talk about. And they're not small things. I mean, I think for me, I'm looking for a candidate who understands these issues, has been following it, has been vocal about it. And, you know, Biden is coming out of this, is coming into this race late and saying very little. And I think it's very, very telling about the issues that he doesn't want to talk about. And the fact that there's like, and the ones he does, there's very little specificity. And it's like, I know he knows these issues. It's more, I think he's kind of making the political judgment that it's not worth kind of bringing up all this to the surface. And I think, I don't know, I think that's like just really short-sighted, because I feel like the Democratic base is looking for someone who believes in what they're saying and is going to fight for it rather than carefully chooses what they're willing to talk about.
Yeah, and I think he's trying to convince people that he doesn't have to fight, that if they just vote for him, he'll get the job done and we can forget about disunity. And in fact, he has a line that he repeated twice that almost says exactly that. Let's take a listen.
Yeah. Folks, we know what we have to do. That's why I'm running. As I said, let's stop fighting and start fixing. And we can only do it together.
Okay, Naomi. Well, I think that leads directly into our overall impressions of the speech and anything else we wanted to point out.
I mean, I think for me, I haven't been that excited by much of the Joe Biden coverage, but I thought I would be reminded of kind of what drew me into his candidacy in 2007, or I'd be reminded of kind of his leadership in the Senate, or kind of like this pillar of the Senate and how important he is and how much he's been able to get done and how much we can kind of lean on him. And I think what I got from the speech was actually something very different, which is this is somebody who is a reflection of the past, of someone who has been in our politics for a long time, for better or for worse, but like really for worse too. And that a lot of the frustrations that I know I at least personally have with Congress is the dysfunction and the normalcy of the dysfunction. And even though he hasn't been in the Senate for, you know, 10 years, there's kind of this acceptance almost of this is the institution we have and we kind of have to like slowly work our way back, as opposed to kind of like shaking it vigorously to kind of get it to realign and kind of reconfigure to some, you know, normal institution. And so I was just really surprised by how much I didn't connect.
Yeah, Naomi, there was something you said in particular as we were getting towards what I felt was a very strong closing for the speech that I thought kind of underscored your thinking on this. So let's take a listen to this closing where Joe Biden is making an explicit contrast with President Trump.
Let me ask you, are we a nation that believes there's a moral equivalence between white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the Ku Klux Klan, and those with the courage to stand against them? Yes. No, we don't. But Trump does. Yes. Trump said there's a moral equivalence. Are we a nation that believes ripping children from the arms of their parents at the border? No, we don't, but Trump does. Are we a nation that embraces dictators and tyrants like Putin and Kim Jong-un? We don't, but Trump does. Look, every day we're reminded about this in this election, about we have to be remembered who we are, what we stand for, what we believe. And every day we're reminded there's nothing guaranteed about our democracy. We have to fight for it. We have to defend it. We have to earn it.
Yeah, I mean, I reacted pretty strongly to when I heard this, because the reality is part of America does believe it's okay to separate children at the border. Part of America thinks it's okay to kind of jeopardize people's health insurance. I mean, it's not just President Trump. There's a lot of people in the Republican Party who stand by the decisions of this White House. And, you know, I get that he's at a rally. He's at a rally of his supporters. And so when he says we, in the most literal sense, he could just be talking about the people in front of him. But like, as America, like, yes, there are people who are okay with these things. And I think to deny that reality is irresponsible, because I think we as a country need to recognize that there are people who feel very differently on certain issues. And not to say that we can't kind of have a conversation, that there can't be dialogue, that there can't be even consensus on some things, but to assume that the worst of the decisions that are happening in this country, or just kind of the general animosity in our politics, isn't reflected in our values, that there isn't that kind of clear delineation between communities, I think is just kind of blatantly wrong. And I think everyone needs to kind of like have a real hard look in the mirror of who they sit next to, who do they work next to, and kind of understand, like, what does this mean when the people we live near and work with and kind of play with might not have our best interest in mind. And I don't know, maybe this is very cynical and it's been a long weekend or whatever, but I get really annoyed when people are like, this isn't us. And it's like, actually, it is. America has done some really horrible things in our whole country, you know, once every generation. Like, it's not unheard of. So,
well, and Biden directly says, he has a section where he says, that can't be America. That can't be an American president. But it is, you know, and this country, I'm reading this, you know, working my way through this Jill Lepore History of the United States right now, and just learning about the way that violence and injustice was so imprinted into the soul of this country through slavery and treatment of Native peoples at the beginning. It's just like, this is the reality. You can try to deny it, but to look at those past issues that America has in large part gotten past, right? We don't have slavery anymore. We don't do these, you know, a lot of these terrible things anymore.
I mean, but like, Black people are still shot by
right,
the police.
But what I'm saying is to say that bad things happening today are the worst that things have ever been, like, that's absolutely not true at all. And that America has always been struggling against these forces and will continue to. Parts of this speech remind me quite a bit of the speech about the silent majority of Americans.
In San Francisco, a few weeks ago, I saw demonstrators carrying signs reading, "Lose in Vietnam, bring the boys home." Well, one of the strengths of our free society is that any American has a right to reach that conclusion and to advocate that point of view. But as President of the United States, I would be untrue to my oath of office if I allowed the policy of this nation to be dictated by the minority who hold that point of view and who try to impose it on the nation by mounting demonstrations in the street. If a vocal minority, however fervent its cause, prevails over reason and the will of the majority, this nation has no future as a free society. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
So that was Nixon, and the speech was very important historically, but the main point that he's making there, it's a reaction to the civil rights movement, to the unrest in the country, to there were riots happening in America at the time. There were women who were demanding their rights. The point Nixon was making is, yeah, there's all this division and conflict out there that you see in the newspaper all the time, but there's also this silent majority, these Americans who just get up, go to work every day, do their job, and don't want to have to deal with all that. And, you know, we can be, I don't know, it was almost like a ploy to silence and suppress these bad things and almost even ignore these bad things, or not even bad things, because obviously civil rights is a good thing, but it was kind of a, I don't want to think about that. And that's what this kind of reminds me of a little bit. Like, Biden is saying, Trump is not us, and the Democrats who want to fight, that's not going to win. If you want to fight, just choose Trump because he's a fighter. There's this silent majority of Americans that I'm talking to as Joe Biden that want unity and want to just get things done like we used to get things done.
I think that's extremely astute. I think that's pretty much right on kind of how I feel about this, where it's like, oh, what a privilege you have to be able to ignore how certain people are experiencing this country, it's really tempting. It's so tempting to kind of buy that message and live by it. But I think we have a responsibility to each other to care about what's going on. And I think that's kind of my reticence of kind of buying into anything that Joe Biden is saying right now, at least in this speech.
And there is a tension within the speech. It's not like he doesn't recognize problems and issues that exist. He brings them up, and you've heard many of them in the clips that we've played today. But there is this tension in the speech between that side that wants to say, as we played just a minute ago,
let's stop fighting and start fixing.
Stop fighting, start fixing. That's in this speech. But then he also has this line in the speech. Take a listen to this.
And every day we're reminded there's nothing guaranteed about our democracy. We have to fight for it.
So both in the same speech, he says, stop fighting and we have to fight for it. And you can't have it both ways. You know, I think that's kind of the point of this. Like, you can't have it both ways. You can't tell people to calm down, but also stand up.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Naomi, you had another point after we discussed this that I thought was really good, which is you said young people will see Biden and say, oh, if he's elected, my life's not going to change.
I had a lot of heavy revelations after this speech. I'm remembering. Yeah, I think it's really stayed with me, the comment from, I think it was it Matthew Dowd on This Week? But there was a panel where they were essentially saying, how does Biden create a narrative that is dissimilar from Hillary Clinton's, essentially, where, you know, I'm attached to this legacy administration. I have all this experience. I can do this. I have the experience for this moment. And that is very similar to kind of the messaging of Hillary Clinton, which was not successful. And that he has to really find a new voice, but he's not a new person in, you know, DC politics. And so that has really stuck with me. And listening to this speech, I just thought, yeah, like how if you're under the age of, I would say, 35, 30 years old, definitely under the age of 25, you would hear this speech and it's just like the same old, same old. Like this person doesn't think my life needs to change very much.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that I think is going to be a question that Joe Biden will get is, well, first of all, a lot of the successes of the, call it Obama-Biden administration, were in those first few years when they did have a majority because Republicans were so obstinate. And so I think a major question to Joe Biden is, how would you do things differently than Barack Obama in the last years of his presidency to ensure that the things that you value, that you say you want to get done, like a Medicare buy-in, or which is going to be a huge change, or combating climate change, or free community college? Like, how are you going to get this done in a better way than Obama did? How would you approach this differently? And that's going to be a hard question to answer for him. Because if he doesn't say that he's going to do things differently from Obama in that respect, that he's not going to be more successful, how can we expect him to move the goals forward, to move the goalposts forward, to advance or advance the ball? I obviously don't know enough about sports to make these analogies, but it's like you got to move things forwards. And if you're going to do the exact same thing you already did and expect a different result, who's going to vote for that?
Well, lots to think about. And, you know, we'll see if Joe Biden kind of massages his go-to speech and maybe even adds a little bit more futuristic tones. I think that would be something.
Flying cars.
So he didn't talk about driverless vehicles. So that's another thing he didn't talk about. But I appreciated this exercise to kind of think more comprehensively about Joe Biden as a candidate. And I think sometimes in the Sunday morning political shows or kind of just looking through Twitter, it's kind of very soundbitey, like, oh, that's a stupid thing he said, or that's really interesting. And it's very kind of select pieces. And I appreciated this exercise. And this was your idea. So this is a thank you to Brendan to kind of look at a speech and say, hey, what is this person trying to do? What are they succeeding at? And how do I feel about it?
The final thing I'll ask Naomi is, do you think he was effective in delivering this message?
No, the microphone was garbage.
Well, okay.
We had lots of audio issues.
There were tons of audio issues. I think that was for the broadcast networks trying to pick up the microphone. I think everyone in the audience got it. But guess what? The majority of the audience, there were more people watching on TV and on YouTube and on C-SPAN than were there in person. So absolutely, that's a miss. His team should be fixing
that. Get it together.
Yeah, get it freaking together. But overall, I'd say delivery, kind of slow in the beginning, quiet in the beginning. We all know this about Joe Biden, who've watched him. He modulates his speech a ton, which is good. It's not monotone. That's great. But he'll go from really quiet, really, folks. Oh my, I will tell you, folks, from the bottom of my heart, this Republican, and it's like, oh my gosh, the dynamic range is too great. So he started very low, ended very loud, and ended strong, I felt. So I don't know. I think that was good. That was well done. But there weren't enough personal anecdotes, stories. He didn't talk enough about his resume. There was a little bit of humor, not enough, mostly about somebody whistling, blowing a whistle in the background. Didn't use a lot of statistics. But overall, I feel like he achieved what he wanted to achieve. I don't know that that's necessarily the best thing to achieve, but it definitely made him stand out. Well, that's it for Polylog this week, and every week we encourage you to make your dialogue count, and this week we encourage you to get the audio right. This was an absolute nightmare. No, it really was. It was very difficult to get good audio from this event, which is probably why it wasn't covered as well as he maybe wanted it to be. But what's our real dialogue challenge, Naomi?
Our dialogue challenge for this week is to kind of step away or put down your phone and move away from the Facebook posts and the status or the tweet and just read something end to end, listen to something end to end, and kind of reflect and think about it and try to get a feel for kind of what you feel about it.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say, like, go to the source material, but you said it much better than I did. You can email us at podcast@polylog.com. You can follow me at beastidal on Twitter.
You can follow me on Twitter at @SeroNaomi_, and you can follow the show at PolylogCast. We're also on Instagram at Polylog.
We are out there. And of course, if you like the show, please rate us or share it with a friend. It really makes a huge difference to get the word out there, or just say something nice about it in passing and maybe they'll look it up and say, Poly what? Poly huh? Polylog.
Thanks everyone, and we'll talk to you next week.
And of course, next week we will be back with a regular episode covering our four Sunday morning political shows.